From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Superstition Hotline and open lines this Friday the 13th. And at the end of the show, a letter from Michael. You will find this to be one of the most heartwarming letters you have ever heard, read by a Detroit great radio broadcaster, Lee Allen. I'm going to bring that to you at the end of the show. Don't miss it. Well, U.S. officials say that American airstrikes in Pakistan overnight, that's right, Pakistan overnight, were aimed at the number two man in the Al-Qaeda terror organization, Ayman al-Zarahori, if that is how you pronounce his name. Now, he's the one who has always been seen lately in various videotapes. He's the one with the glasses. One official said intelligence indicated a strong possibility that he was in a Pakistani village at the time of the airstrike, but there is no confirmation that he was killed. Pakistani officials say U.S. aircraft, apparently CIA Predator drones, fired as many as 10 missiles at the residential compound. Now, reports are indicating, though, as many as 30 villagers, including some women and children, were also killed. The attack came in a region of northwest Pakistan along the Afghanistan border. The CIA Predators carry as many as 4 Hellfire missiles. Only last month, the CIA used a Predator to kill the number 3 man in Al-Qaeda in a similar Hellfire strike in Pakistan. Killing al-Zarahiri would be a major psychological victory for the United States in its war on terrorism. He, not Osama bin Laden, has emerged recently as the chief operator for Al-Qaeda. They say they have a sample of his DNA. They will check. Iran has threatened to block inspections of its nuclear sites if confronted by the UN Security Council over its atomic activities. The hardline president reaffirmed his country's intention to produce nuclear energy. The move came a day after France, Britain, and Germany, backed by the United States, said that nuclear talks with Iran had reached a dead end after more than 2 years of negotiations, and the issue should be referred to the Security Council. With the support of Russia and China uncertain, they refrained from calling on the 15-nation council to impose sanctions and said they remained open to more talks. Meanwhile, Israeli military planners have more confidence in the success of an attack on Iran's nuclear weapons facilities and have already begun sending signals to Iran that it will not be permitted to threaten the Jewish state with annihilation. The new government of acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert also wants the Mullah government in Iran to understand that the incapacitation of Ariel Sharon will not leave Israel in any less state of readiness. Yesterday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice expressed strong U.S. support for a European move to take the issue of Iran's nuclear program to the UN Security Council. And Prime Minister Sharon's failure to wake up from a coma 9 days after suffering a massive stroke does not bode well for his recovery, according to some doctors. With extensive brain damage looking likely, Israelis have begun to look ahead to life without him. He's 77 years old. He has remained in critical but stable condition, but is showing no signs of emerging from this coma. Matt Drudge reports on thedrudgereport.com that the chief judge in the trial of Saddam Hussein plans to step down in a development that could throw an already turbulent process into further disarray. The killing of 2 defense lawyers has already highlighted problems with the process in a country mired in a virtual civil war. No word on why the judge wants to sit and leave. In Florida, a Milwee Middle School 8th grader who last year threatened to blow up a school bus showed up for class Friday with a pistol in his backpack. However, classmates of Chris Penley, a 15-year-old, didn't know it was a pellet gun. And neither did a veteran county deputy sheriff who made a split-second decision to open fire when Chris pointed the weapon at him. The deputy's single shot gravely wounded the boy, who was on life support at the Orlando Regional Medical Center. By all things that I see here, I think the deputy did the right thing. A volcano on an uninhabited island 180 miles from Anchorage erupted twice on Friday, sending plumes of ash more than 6 miles into the sky. Airplanes were warned to keep at least 5 miles away from the 4,134-foot Augustine volcano. In Oklahoma, grass fires there have destroyed at least 24 homes, forced hundreds of evacuations. Extremely dry weather there, despite snowfall. The worst fire raged in southern Oklahoma, where it burned through at least 20 homes overnight. Comets have long lit up the sky in the imagination of scientists. Now these icy bodies from the beginnings of the solar system are finally ready for a close-up. 6 months now after NASA scientists first peeked inside one comet from afar, they're bringing pieces of another to Earth for study under a microscope. This weekend, the Stardust spacecraft will jettison a 100-pound capsule holding comet dust. It will nosedive through the Earth's atmosphere, and if all goes well, will make a soft landing in the Utah desert. Stephen Cates, Dr. Skies, we call him, is an astronomical journalist and lecturer. He's been involved in the science of astronomy for well over 30 years. His website is drsky.com. He got his start in astronomy when he was 6 years old, living in the New York City area. We're going to go to him right now and chat with him about this incredible Stardust mission. Stephen, welcome to Coast to Coast. This is exciting stuff.
Well, good morning. Yes, George, and I'm glad to be back with you. Happy New Year to you and
you
the listeners.
Too. You
this
too.
Is great stuff.
Now, tell me about this dust that they've captured. I mean, what really do you think it is?
Well, here's the scoop on this. This is fascinating.
The scoop? Now, you'd be a little pun, huh?
Well, the whole spacecraft itself, Stardust, is, many people may not realize, captured, we hope it captured some dust, cometary particles from the origin of the universe. Well, this happening, of course, about a year ago, and maybe we didn't get a lot of press coverage on this. It actually imaged and hopefully captured particles of a comet called Vilt 2. And as you correctly mentioned, this recovery capsule will be entering the Earth's atmosphere as we move into early Sunday morning for the people in the West Coast, starting to be visible, hopefully, if weather conditions are good, over Crescent City, Northern California. George, if I were planning a place to be for this thing, I would be somewhere in the northern part of Nevada along Route 80. And I've talked to a lot of these scientists, as I'm sure you're going to be talking to throughout the night. But what I think is so fascinating about this is we're hopefully bringing back this time successfully, unlike maybe Genesis with solar wind particles, actual cometary debris from the beginning of the universe, talking about and hopefully giving us answers to why we're here in this universe, how it all started, great science. And even more important, from the Dr. Sky perspective, what a fireball people are going to see tomorrow into early Sunday morning, I should say. Sunday morning actually is the best time.
It's going to be as bright as Venus, they say.
And maybe even brighter. And you know something? We were talking earlier this week on some local stuff we do here in Phoenix on TV and radio to some of the crew members. NASA's sending up one of their DC-8 modified jet aircraft to actually go into the path of this and study it. Great science, George, for all the future of reentry objects, when we go hopefully to the planet Mars someday, when we return humankind, let's say, back from the moon. We're going to learn a lot from this. But folks, if you're listening in those western states, Northern California, Nevada, the state of Washington, Oregon, you may get to see, and including Utah, a very spectacular fireball. And as you mentioned, George, of course, the Dr. Sky website is jam-packed with information and viewing tips for all the Coast to Coast AM listening audience.
Well, let's hope the parachute opens up this weekend, huh, Stephen?
Great stuff.
Very good. Thanks, Stephen, for the update. And when we come back, we'll be back with none other than science advisor Richard C. Hoagland. Well, needing no real introduction, the head of the EnterpriseMission.com and our Coast to Coast science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, joins us for a few moments as we talk about a couple incredible things happening in space. What you've just heard, of course, is Project Stardust, and also there's a trip to Pluto planned very soon. Richard, how are you?
Good evening, George. Well, I'm suffering a bit from a cold. Robin and I came down with whatever's going around. Fortunately, with her menstruations, in 2 days, I've gone through what normally takes 2 weeks, and I'm almost on the mend here.
She is one of the best alternative medicine doctors
I
know.
Well, she sure saved my life.
Absolutely. Oh, she sure did. Richard, first of all, the Stardust Project. If the parachute opens, we might have a great little scientific find here, huh?
And if it doesn't, we may have an international incident.
Yeah, Tom, tell me about that, because this is a possibility.
I don't want to disagree with Dr. Skye, but I'm going to disagree with him emphatically, because I think that what Stardust is bringing home are not pieces of something older than the sun, older than the universe, older than the solar system. I think what NASA is going to find, if we can get honest guys to look at this, you know, these little puffs of grains that were captured in the aerogel about 6 months ago when they passed WILT 2, I think they're going to find that comets and asteroids are part of Tom Van Flandern's exploded planet. They're going to find the remnants of a well-differentiated, very ancient body that was like the Earth until it one day decided to blow up. Now, what they also may find, and this is where things get really interesting, George, they may have captured not only organic molecules, but viruses, microbes. God, they could have even captured a plant.
Well, the Andromeda strain is
here. Exactly. Now, the NASA people who are in charge of quarantine of anything that leaves and comes back said that they automatically discounted this because cometary material has been falling on the Earth for billions of years, to which I would respond, but that's objects that normally come through the atmosphere and incinerate,
mm-hmm.
not objects that are carefully brought back in a protected capsule at 28,000 miles per hour and are supposed to be landing safely in the Utah desert to be picked up and analyzed by scientists.
Have they taken any special precautions?
None. Zero. Zip. Nada. This is the arrogance of science. Remember I said a few weeks ago that this arrogance could wind up killing people?
Yes, I remember that.
This is the kind of arrogance that can wind up killing people. We're looking at something here right out of the Andromeda Strain, a movie I heartily recommend to everyone who is within the sound of my voice. I don't think, you know, realistically that's going to happen, because I think the spacecraft will come down safely. I would hope that there would be a lot of pressure by people on NASA to keep this thing in quarantine. You know, level 4 would be nice with the use of the CDC.
Mm-hmm.
I would have preferred if they had rendezvoused this thing with the space station and kept it outside the atmosphere and analyzed the contents in glove boxes with overpressures and all that. But that's not going to happen because of the arrogance of people who think they know our backyard, and they don't. And what we're going to find out, again, from the honest analysis, is that there are surprises in this little package that are going to blow some people's minds, because Tom is correct. The data is overwhelming now from not only the Stardust mission itself when it passed WILT 2 and took photographs of an object that looked nothing like anybody had imagined a comet should look like. I mean, isn't it weird, George, that we take pictures of all these objects, asteroids and comets, and they're all supposed to have formed in the same process, which means they should all kind of look the same?
Yeah, and
they're
not.
And none of them look like the next one or the last one?
They're like snowflakes. They're all different.
They're all radically different, indicating they formed in an incredibly different, chaotic environment, which is what you'd expect when a planet blows up. Different regions will produce different results.
Would they tell us if they find some kind of organism, virus, something in this comet dust?
I'm counting on honest guys, people like Don Yeomans and the people who are in charge of Stardust, to be so blown away that they will inadvertently blurt out, oh my God, this is amazing. And I think there's a lot of people on the web, a lot of smart people, you know, following with blogs and with, you know, people like the folks in the Planetary Society and others who are going to be asking them lots and lots of questions. What they need to do is ask them questions about the life process, not just, you know, inorganic stuff that could lead to life, but are they going to find, will they find in these little aerogels that are kind of like, you know, flying ice cubes
mm-hmm.
that catch this stuff very, moving very fast.
I mean, how much dust do you think they captured, by the way, Richard?
How much?
How much dust? I mean, if you looked at it with a naked eye, would you see a whole vial full almost, or microscopic?
No, it's microscopic, but with the instrumentalities that we have these days, it's equivalent to capturing mountains. They can do so much with so little. The science is that good that they will have enough to really tell us where this thing came from. And your key question, George, is exactly right. Will they have the courage to tell us if it completely contradicts every theory they've got going out there for the last 20, 30 years?
Wouldn't it be amazing? I mean, absolutely stunning. All these missions we've attempted, the apparent search for life in an indirect way, the rovers, everything we've done on the moon. Wouldn't it be incredible if they actually captured life by grabbing it from a comet.
Well, you know, this is an interesting reprise of an idea that Fred Hoyle and his partner at Cardiff University, Wickrama Singh, published several years ago. The late Sir Fred Hoyle was a brilliant cosmologist. He was well known in astrophysics. He deserved a Nobel Prize, but they don't give them for astronomy, so he never was in line for that. He and his writing partner, his research partner, have proposed for several years that periodic flu epidemics around the planet are really caused by the Earth picking up flu strains, viruses, from interplanetary space when we go through the clouds, and that's why we get these outbreaks that appear to have no cause. Like, for instance, SARS appeared to be very much one of these outbreaks. What would be really remarkable is if this mission were to confirm Hoyle's and Wickrama Singh's most controversial theory 20-some years after they first proposed it.
Oh, this is going to be exciting. Very exciting. Monday night, of course, it'll be a day or so after all this happens. We should chat just to see if we have any updates from you on this.
Yeah, okay? Well, we've got a link on Enterprise to the Stardust mission site. There's actually a countdown clock, which is up there right now. It is now literally 1 day, 3 hours, 45 minutes, 30 seconds and counting till this thing comes home.
All right, very good. Couple things I want to talk with you about. First of all, I had a chance to interview this week Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic.
Heads up,
Skeptic Magazine. And he has he's willing to come and debate three people on Coast to Coast in the not-too-distant future, of which I then asked our vast audience to send me three names, and so I've got thousands of emails with three names in there. So we started looking at them and adding them up, and I wanted to approach all three of the highest, you know, numbered people.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, one of the high ones. I don't want to embellish your ego, so I'm not going to tell you where you showed. So I want you to think about it. Do some work in it. I'm calling it the skeptic's cage. Two enter, one comes out.
Oh, God.
It's going to be almost like a no holds barred type of thing.
You really think you're P.T. Barnum, don't you?
I sometimes do. So think about it, Richard. It's offered to you. You're one of the high three.
Okay.
And it would be a program. You'd be on for an hour with him. And
I presume this will be after we do the February Expo,
yes,
in Los Angeles?
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
well,
so Robin and I are speaking.
I
didn't mention that Robin is speaking tonight. I don't get my pills, so I have to mention that.
All right, do that. And yes, it will be after that. I want you to have some time to prepare because he's pretty sharp.
Well, this sounds like it could be intriguing. If he'll play fair, if we'll deal with data,
fair.
This could be very interesting.
He's fair. He seemed to be fair. He did a whole program with us, and I think you would be a very good match for him. Don't forget, though, to enter, one comes out.
I heard that, yes.
All right, the other thing, this comet, Pluto probe.
Oh, yes.
This thing, we only have a few minutes here, but this, how can it go so fast? They say it could get there in 9 years.
Because they're sending it on a souped-up version of the Atlas. The Atlas V now kind of rebuilt, streamlined,
okay,
you know, redesigned. It's kind of like Steve, what's in Austin, the Bionic Man. We can rebuild him better than before, that kind of thing. They basically are sending this thing on the fastest possible rocket we've got, which, of course, is archaic technology, but it's all we've got in the public sector. It'll take 9 years to get there. It's about the size of a grand piano, loaded for bear, although we don't expect to see bears, polar or otherwise, on Pluto. And it will be 9 years from the night it's launched, more or less. It'll be an extraordinary mission. They're going to start taking pictures about a year ahead of time. So really, it's 8 years, George. You and I can hold our breath for 8 years, right?
I think we can do that. This
it's
is going
to
be exciting.
It's supposed to get there in 2014, 2015.
They're going to see the window closes February 14th, and they won't have the next opportunity until 2007. So they got to do it. They've got to
do
this.
Well, the window opens. The launch is scheduled for now Tuesday evening, I believe. Check me on that.
I think you're right.
Website. But it's going to be extraordinary because this really is a mission that is going to take us to a place we've never seen before. There's an incredible story by Larry Niven about how Pluto really came to be. And, of course, it has nothing to do with real science. It's great science fiction. I recommend everybody do a Google search on Pluto and Larry Niven.
Niven's one of the best. I had lunch with him about 2 years ago.
He is a hell of a guy.
Great guy. By the way, Godman E.T., Richard, I'd like to give this out because it is a wonderful, critically acclaimed DVD series. You're much too shy to give me this number, so I had to pull it out. It's 877-345-6222, or it's on the enterprisemission.com website, 877-345-6222. This is a DVD series of a conference that Richard put on with a number of heavy hitters called God, Man, and E.T. Take a look at it. If you love this kind of science, you're going to love this. Richard, thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
I'll talk to you Monday night.
Take care of that cold. Richard C. Hoagland. When I come right back, we're going to talk a little bit about Friday the 13th. You know, according to the Smithsonian Magazine, the fear of 13 is the nation's favorite superstition. The fear of 13 costs the United States $1 billion a year in absenteeism, travel cancellations, reduced commerce on the 13th of every month, whether a Friday or not, according to this magazine. The collision of Friday, the sixth day of the week, and number 13 is considered ominous, and it occurs up to 3 times a year. Interesting. Well, how about this, too? In the year 2029, there's an asteroid that could get very close to planet Earth. As a matter of fact, if gravity pulls it in, it's going to hit us. It's not planning to hit us. It's called Apophis. It's Greek for the destroyer. That will come by on Friday the 13th. Just so you know. In a moment, our guest is Nathaniel Leckenmeyer. He is an expert. His book is called 13, The Story of the World's Most Popular Superstition. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Nathaniel Leckenmeyer is an award-winning author of books for adults and children. His works have been translated into 6 languages and have won 3 book awards. 13, The Story of the World's Most Notorious Superstition, is his 2nd book for adults. He lives in New York. Are you superstitious, Nathaniel, by any chance?
I'm not, although I was driving home tonight. There was a very, very heavy fog. It was like something out of a horror movie, and I was a little nervous.
It does get to you. These are special open line nights for us, because all kinds of things happen on this night. And then tomorrow night is a full moon coupled with this. So that's a pretty back-to-back situation for us here. How did you begin to research 13?
Really by accident. I found an old scrapbook that had old newspaper articles from the late 1800s, and one of them talked about something called the 13 Club and said that person or persons unknown had tried to blow it up, and I had no idea what the 13 Club was, and I started to look into it and found out that it's this was a prominent social club that's now been forgotten, but its goal was to eradicate, you know, the belief in unlucky 13, and it counted among its honorary members and members 5 successive presidents, lots of politicians. In its day, it was quite a popular institution.
I mean, because it's quite a number. I mean, airlines don't have 13 in for rows, most of them, at least the planes I've been on. Elevators don't have a 13th floor. Some hospitals don't have a 13th floor. It seems to be that people go out of their way to avoid that number.
It's true, although it used to be more true. One of the things I found out, researching the history of 13 is really it's on the wane, the superstition. The peak was from about 1860 to 1940. Especially in the late 1800s, everybody took it very, very seriously. I mean, it was a very serious issue, and people were afraid, for example, if they sat 13 at a table, that it was all but certain that one would die within a year. That was a popular superstition at the time. But especially in the last 50 years, it's really on the decline.
How did it begin, this origin of 13?
Well, that was interesting, too, because a lot of the sort of popular theories that are thrown around, you know, suggest that it has a very ancient origin. But looking into it, the first written reference to unlucky 13, you don't find that until the late 1600s. And basically, it emerged as a reinterpretation of the 13 of the Last Supper, which had been seen as benevolent, mm-hmm. because it was the 13 of Christ and the 12 disciples. And then at that point, it changed, and it became the unlucky 13 of the Last Supper.
Were there some pretty people of notoriety who didn't like 13 in your work?
Well, in fact, it really, for starting in the 1800s, I mean, you'd have to, you know, look hard and to find people who did think it wasn't, you know, who weren't afraid of it. But yeah, there were. There always have been. You had in the 20th century, Adolf Hitler was a Triskaidekaphobe. P.T. Barnum of, you know, the Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots and lots of people.
Edgar Allan Poe, I heard.
Yeah.
Hated 13.
Yeah, well, he hated 13. There were a lot of people also that made basically, you know, were contrarians and weren't going to let it get to them. Even in those days, you had a lot of people. George Washington looked at 13 as lucky because of the 13 colonies. And really, the 13 superstition didn't appear in the U.S. until the 1800s. Prior to that, it was in the late 1700s, 13 was considered lucky because it was associated with the 13 colonies and then the 13 states.
Do some people, you know, fight it and just simply want everything with 13?
Yo, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that in the last 50 years has really killed off the unlucky superstition, or at least made it a lot less common, is that, you know, there's emerged a counter trend to look at 13 as lucky. And that's what the members of the 13 Club did. They basically, what they would do, for example, is they would sit 13 at a table to test fate and prove, you know, to the public that no one would die within a year and that it wasn't really unlucky. And they did that over many, many years, and they fared well with that. So they were Triskaidekaphiles, people who liked 13 in the 1800s, and you certainly have that tradition today.
Of course, you've heard the phrase, Houston, we have a problem. That
yes,
tied
absolutely.
Into Apollo 13. Now listen to this fact here, Nathaniel.
Sure. Apollo
13 was launched at 13:13 hours Central Time from pad 39, 13 times 3, and aborted on April 13th, though it wasn't a Friday. There's a lot of 13s involved with numbers.
Oh, it's true. It's true. You know, but you really, you could probably do something similar with any other number, you know, looking at other events. We've learned to, whenever we see something, you know, experience something unlucky or unfortunate, to look for 13s, to associate it with 13s. For example, I mentioned the being nervous driving tonight. The reason I was not because I'm superstitious of Friday the 13th, but there have actually been studies that show that Friday the 13th is a more dangerous day to drive than any other day of the year. And the argument that, you know, people who aren't superstitious at least make is that's because people are more nervous and more likely to get into accidents.
No, that's a good point, because I'm just wondering if it's the number for people who are unlucky with it, 13, if it's the number, or if they've surrounded themselves with, you know, such negative energy because of the number, they do it to themselves.
Well, yeah, and I guess in the case of accidents, there's always the possibility they maybe get nervous enough they do it to someone else. One of the things that's most interesting about Friday the 13th is that really, you know, that's our most popular 13 superstition. You have, you know, countless permutations of unlucky 13, 13th floor and 13th aisle and airplanes, all that stuff. But Friday the 13th only emerged in the 20th century. It was unheard of before the 20th century, which is something that isn't that well known.
In the Far East, though, 13's not an unlucky number.
That's right. Four is a very, very unlucky number, because the word for four, the spoken word for four, is the same as the spoken word for death. And so there's a very different, you know, reason for it. It's a different tradition. But four is considered much more unlucky in Korea, Japan, and China today than 13 is in the West. And actually, one way you can test that is there's only one U.S. airlines that still it omits the 13th row in an airplane.
That's Continental, isn't it?
That's right, Continental. And but if you look at airplanes that go to the Far East, they'll consistently omit the row four, you know, sort of in deference to their clients.
And that's my lucky number.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I was born on a four, and I've always had it as my lucky. It's funny how people do that, then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I haven't decided if 13 is lucky for not, you know, or not for me. You'll have to let me know at the end of it.
If you polled a lot of people, Nathaniel, how many would say 13 is an unlucky number? I don't like it. I stay away from it.
Well, the last poll that was done was in 2000, and you know, coincidentally or not, 13% of the people polled felt that it was unlucky. If you go back to the 1930s, and really for, you know, 50 years before that, the number would have been up around 90%. So it was very, very prevalent then.
It was, of course, a very unlucky day for Christians, was it not?
Absolutely. And that's really, that's where the tradition came from. The interesting thing is, I didn't realize this before I started researching 13, is prior to the late 1600s, where this switch happened, where the public started looking at 13 as unlucky because of the events of the that followed the Last Supper, 13 was actually considered a benevolent number by the church because it was the 13 of Christ and the 12 disciples. And what's interesting is the church was one of the main sort of organizations or institutions that were fighting 13. So, when you want to, one of the ways I tried to find out, when 13 began was actually to look and see when religious writers started to say that 13 isn't, don't believe that 13 is unlucky because it's a sin to be superstitious. And that's one way I was able to figure out when it began.
After this interview this hour, if you're somewhere near a radio, listen to the rest of the show because I'm going to open up a superstition hotline. And
cool.
We're going to get all kinds of calls with that one, Nathaniel. Why are people generally superstitious?
Well, that's a great question. I don't have an answer for you. I think people, Bertrand Russell, a philosopher, English philosopher, said that people have to believe something, and in the absence of good reason for belief, they'll accept bad reason. I think one of the things I learned, researching this book is that one of the things that was interesting was to discover all the strange theories that people came up with to explain 13, and you very quickly start to realize that there's very little connection between historical evidence and what people actually believe. So I see superstition as just another sort of set of irrational beliefs, but I don't believe that it's harmful. You have a lot of people out there, rationalists, who really think that superstition is terrible and it needs to be eradicated. I don't look at it that way.
No, as a matter of fact, after this interview with you, I'm going to confront 13 and not run from it anymore because I got to tell you, even I have shied away from that number as much as I could.
Yeah. How are you going to confront it?
Well, I mean, if I ever see it or something,
I thought you meant like the minute this, I thought you had a plan.
Yeah, right. Me with a plan on 13?
Right.
I mean, could we develop a plan?
We could. Well, that's what the 13 clubbers sitting, if you have 12 close friends who don't get scared easily, join them for a late night meal, 13 at a table. And if you're around in a year, we'll talk. Because the 13 of the...
Well, unfortunately, I don't have 13 friends, Nathaniel.
I have the same problem. I couldn't test it. But that prior to the 20th century, that was the dominant 13 superstition, was 13 at a table. And that switch to Friday the 13th happened just 100 years ago.
Yeah, we could have dinner in a place like the House on the Haunted Hill.
That would be good. I won't be joining you. That would scare me, I think.
The movements of Hollywood with 13 haven't helped either, has it?
Oh, no, absolutely. You're right. The Friday the 13th movies really kind of helped sustain the superstition. More than that, it helped sustain public awareness of the superstition. So it's interesting, too, because I interviewed the screenwriter of the original Friday the 13th, and the original title was, The original title of Friday the 13th was Long Night at Camp Blood. Was the title.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm glad they changed it. I think it was smart. And they changed it actually for a very pragmatic reason, which was Halloween had been such a hit 2 years before that they wanted to capitalize on kind of the calendar association. And so from their point of view, they weren't remotely superstitious. They just thought, here's a chance to do better box office. And it's interesting how the things that are sort of arbitrary decisions can have such a huge, impact on cultural belief because they made that change, and the rest is history. It's had a huge impact on people believing 13 is unlucky, people being aware of it. It's also, Friday the 13th has also carried the superstition to other cultures, which is kind of interesting.
Well, in Latin countries, they hate the number 13,
that's right.
Don't they?
They hate the number. What's interesting is in Spain and Greece, they have a different day superstition related to 13. It was Tuesday the 13th.
Tuesday? Why?
I think it has to do with the fall of Constantinople, but here you're reaching the outer bounds. See, I had to study Friday the 13th. I didn't have to look at Tuesday as much. But no, it has to do with the fall of Constantinople. But the interesting thing is, so they had a Tuesday the 13th superstition. Then Friday the 13th, the movie comes out, and it's translated literally, as Friday the 13th. And they had no idea. This meant nothing in those cultures, but except maybe, I'm sure they probably knew that we looked at it as superstitious. But in any case, it's really, you can trace to the distribution of Friday the 13th in those countries, the birth of a competing calendar 13 superstition. So you have some people now in Spain and Greece who think Friday the 13th is unlucky, and others who think Tuesday the 13th is unlucky, and it's all because of a movie.
Back in the early 1900s, there was a stock speculator, Thomas Lawson, and he wrote a book called Friday the 13th. Was that primarily, it was a novel. What was that about the stock market? Or
It was a terrible novel that he was a very successful stock speculator, and he promoted this novel very successfully and very aggressively. It was actually that the first Friday, there was an earlier Friday the 13th movie, and it was made in 1916, and it was a version of his novel. And his novel was very successful, and what he did for the first time, prior to that point, you had two distinct superstitions, which you alluded to at the beginning. One was you had a unlucky Friday, which was based on Friday being the hangman's day, and that was a superstition that had carried forward into the 20th century. And then you had unlucky 13, which any 13th day of the month was unlucky. And what he did was focus on Friday. So, Friday the 13th was considered unluckier in 1900, for example, than other days. But it was only considered unluckier because it was these two superstitions coming together. And what he did was basically fuse the two superstitions as one in the popular mind. And from that point on, you have Friday the 13th as its own superstition. And really, you can trace prior to the research I did, the earliest known reference to Friday the 13th was from 1913, and I basically was able to trace it back to the year his book was published, which was 1907. Mm-hmm. And it very, very quickly, within 10 years, was the most popular 13 superstition.
Do you know if the military has a superstition about 13? I mean, do they avoid anything specifically?
You know, I don't know. I did actually write to some of them, and I can't remember who it was now. Someone had told me 13 was actually his lucky number. I forget, it was a general, I don't remember who, because that's the peg he wound up with. He was a pilot, and when he would hang up his coat. But no, not offhand, I don't know.
Now, of course, the book is already out, right?
Yes.
13. How do you find it?
Oh, you can find it online or at bookstores, and it's put out by Plume.
And your website is linked at coasttocoastam.com, Nathaniel, but your name is so long, I want you to spell it for people.
Well, I could change it for you. Should I just change it?
Yeah, change it to, Paul 13 or something.
Exactly, that's right. You want me to spell it?
Yeah, would you please?
First name is Nathaniel. It's Nathaniel. Last name is the bane of my existence. It's Lackenmeyer. It's Lachenmeyer. And, yeah, I have a website that's NathanielLackenmeyer.com.
.com, okay. And then we've got you linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You would actually change your name for us?
At a drop of a hat. Absolutely.
let's add up your numbers in your name. Let's see. Last name. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I thought maybe you might have 13 down
there. No, but that was the combined. People would avoid, one of the things 100 years ago they do is when they were picking kids' names, they would make sure that the first and last name did not add up to 13, and Thomas Lawson did. His does add up to 13.
Well, you know what's funny? Glynis McCants, who is a numerologist, comes on the program quite a bit. She says you add numbers across, so if 13 was an unlucky number for people and you add it to the lowest common denominator,
right,
1 plus 3 ends up being 4, which people, of course, in the Far East are afraid of.
There you go. You know, that's too much math for me. I can't. I'll trust you on that.
1 plus 3, it's 4. Go check it.
I'll check it.
It will. In parting, what do people do about Friday the 13th?
Oh, I think enjoy it. It's a great. It's a cultural tradition. Oscar Wilde talked about. He was a Triskaidekaphile. He loved 13, and he said something about 13 being superstition being the thought color of our imagination, something that didn't make a lot of sense, but basically the idea was it's fun, it's an interesting tradition, and it's not one that it probably won't be around forever, so enjoy it while it's here.
Well, maybe it'll change for a lot of people. Maybe luck will change for people. We need a good year. Nathaniel, thanks. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Nathaniel Lackenmeyer, who's prepared to change his name for us if we ask him to. No need to. I'll be back in a moment. 3 hours of open lines this Friday the 13th with a special hotline. I call it the Superstition Hotline. 818-817-0021 is that number. 818-817-0021. We'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.